X-Ray.
Welcome to Oh My Dollar, a personal finance show with a dash of glitter. Dealing with money can be scary and stressful. Here we give practical, friendly advice about money that helps you tackle the financial overwhelm. I'm your host, Lillian Kerbake. Let's talk about money. So, a while back in an episode on retirement savings, I mentioned in passing that Social Security wasn't likely to be around by the time that folks my age hit retirement age. One of our listeners, Kate, pointed out that that was a pretty sweepingly broad statement to make without diving in further. I agree. It's time for me to dive in a bit deeper on the topic of this social safety net for retirement. So Social Security is a pretty complicated topic and involves a lot of policy, so I'm bringing in an expert hitter for this one. I'm really happy to have John Rourke. John is a professor of economics at Reed College, where he studies a variety of issues in state and local public finance, especially in regards to taxation, Social Security, and the elderly. And he's also an active amateur curler in Portland, which is obviously very important to this podcast. thanks for coming in, John.
No, thank you.
Yeah, so I kind of just want to dive in. You do a lot of research around Social Security. I know that one of the papers you've written is like, should you move to a new state in order to save on taxes with your Social Security?
right. Because I focus on state taxes. And so one of the interesting things is the different ways that the states tax or rather don't tax Social Security benefits or pensions or other sorts of things solely based on your age. And it's costing us a fortune. And one of the interesting things is how the states are going to deal with budget crises going forward as they give away more and more of the farm to people who are 65 and older.
Interesting. Yeah, because I mean, well, one of the things we talk a lot about on this show is about the difference between pre and post savings for retirement. And kind of essentially, if you save in a Roth IRA, you might you've already paid taxes on it versus a traditional IRA or a 401k, then you are going to be paying taxes at the time that you pull it out. And it's sort of a betting game, right?
If you're
a young person making a decision about this, you don't really know what's going to happen with taxes by the time you're retirement age. But as you get closer and closer to retirement age, you might make the decision to relocate purely based on the state's taxation. But some of these states are trying to attract retirees to their state.
Yeah, which has always been one of the questions we've wondered is why. from a financial standpoint.
Do they spend a lot of money, retirees?
I think that's the hope.
Interesting.
Is that they spend a lot of money, but they don't really generate a lot.
Yeah.
So it's a question. They have their own little sub-economy.
Mm-hmm.
Healthcare becomes a big component of
that,
right?
Definitely. So in Oregon, where healthcare is a big part of our economy, might make sense.
It might make sense. And so from that standpoint, yeah, it could work. A lot of what I'm seeing in the data and my co-author is seeing in the data is actually this interesting phenomenon where people will move to, like, say, Florida. I'm an East Coaster originally, so that's why I think of Florida. But they move to Florida when they're young elderly, spend all their money, return back home.
When to be close to their kids
when they're if we're going to be morbid, when they're ready to die, they go back home.
Interesting.
And then they become Medicare, Medicaid eligible and drain the state from which they left. So it's not Florida who ends up having to pay for them. It's actually New York. New York loses them. They spend all their money, all their retirement money in Florida. They turn around. They're like, they've got 6 months to live. They turn around, go back to New York to be with the family. And New York has to figure out how to pay for all that last 6 months, which is where basically all the medical spending happens is at end of life care.
Right. Definitely. And that's one of the things, right, is that when we're planning for retirement, one of the things you factor in is how long you think you're going to live.
Yep.
But one of the things is that if you're spending all your retirement money as your life goes on, eventually you're going to be below the threshold where you may be below the threshold at which your assets allow you to qualify for something like Medicaid. And Medicaid will often pay for this end of life care facilities. And I'm here to talk about people's own personal finances. So if you want to plot out for yourself and figure out, how you can master plan that, a lot of retirement is just sort of playing the numbers for yourself. And one of the reasons that I kind of tell folks my age to not plan on Social Security, and we'll dive into more where it'll likely still be around in some form. But I tell people not to plan on it because so much can change between then and now, and you don't want to be stuck up a creek with no assets of your own, especially when you're in your 20s and the power of compound interest means you don't actually need to be saving huge amounts of money in order to get in order to have enough at retirement age to sustain you.
Well, if you think of the history of Social Security, the whole reason it was put in place in 1935, right, is because it was a poverty alleviation program, right? It was not a, here's a retirement account that people are going to be able to live off of.
Right.
It's a social insurance program, and it's really, if you need it, it's here.
Yeah.
kind of thing, right? And it's morphed over time into this is my money and this is going to be my main retirement plan. And it was never designed to do that. It was designed to make sure that you didn't eat cat food when you turned 65. That was really the purpose. And if you think of, you know, what was going on in the 1930s, you can think why we put this in place.
Exactly.
And especially because historically before then, when you got old and retired or whatever, or weren't eligible to work anymore, you lived with your family and your family took care of you until you died. And we had kind of these multi-generational households that we don't really have in the U.S. anymore.
Right.
Right. And then if you have World War One, wipe out the generation behind you a little bit.
Yeah.
Then who's going to support these old folks? And that's what was starting to happen. And so we put this in place as a way to kind of bump up and make sure that, you know, they were okay, especially with, you know, depression and everything else happening at that time. And now it's morphed into kind of some other sort of thing that people keep forgetting what it actually is.
Yeah, is there anything else that we should cover with Social Security? I think the lessons we should take away here are we know nothing right now.
What I would say is that this is a political third rail. You saw when Bush tried to think about this at all that everybody came after him like crazy. Part of this is a voting problem. Because the people who are more likely to vote are the people who actually get Social Security and therefore are not going to allow anything to change.
Yep.
So until X, Y millennials actually vote in large numbers to actually make something happen, we're just going to kick the can down the road. And then you're going to run into a problem eventually like Illinois.
What happened in Illinois?
Where Illinois doesn't have a budget for 3 years and has the biggest unfunded pension liability in the country.
Great.
Right.
That sounds lovely.
That's lovely, right? You've seen that in Oregon, because we're based in Oregon. We see that with PERS and what that is doing to the budget and what that implication is down the road in terms of what we're going to do for school spending. And where, in essence, your taxes, we've made all these promises. I haven't made any of these promises, but the politicians have made these promises on behalf of me and behalf of you and behalf of your listeners that we're going to pay all these pensions.
Yep.
This is the ticking time bomb that nobody has actually ever talked about, and is one you should have a show on this, is eventually that bill is due, and the states can't go bankrupt.
Yep.
So how do they get the money?
And the states can't go bankrupt. This is a little geeky on the policy, but states are supposed to have a balanced budget. So the federal government, they're supposed to, well, Illinois wasn't great at it, but.
It's balanced. It's balanced because you make different bad actuarial assumptions.
Right.
We're going to earn 10% a year.
Yeah.
No. But you make that assumption. If you drop that from 10 to 9.5, all of a sudden the amount of money that has to be paid in to be actuarial balance.
Yep.
Is a lot.
Right.
And so the big deal in Oregon was going from 7.5 to 7.25. And what do we do about that? And all of a sudden it's, you know, $200 billion that is lost from education funding.
Yep.
So as that bill comes to be owed, your taxes are going up at the state level.
Right.
So the one thing to keep in mind, and completely irrelevant from Social Security, is that at some point you're going to be able to make enough money to start deducting stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can't deduct state and local taxes.
Right.
Right. At least you get some of this back. Right. So when you watch Oregon raise its rates and you're like, OK, I can deal with that because at least I get part of it back.
Right.
That ain't happening if they take that part away.
Right.
So, and the threat from the Trump administration is to take that away under tax reform.
Yep. Well, we'll all just move to Washington is the plan. So all of our Oregon listeners will just move to Washington where there's no income tax. It's fine. Yeah. So I guess our lessons are it's complicated. And, you know, from an action item perspective, so if you're in your 20s and 30s and you're kind of trying to plan for future use life,
mm-hmm.
How much should Social Security factor in?
For me, it doesn't factor in at all.
Okay.
For me, it's bonus money.
Okay.
And I think everybody should treat it that way. It's bonus money. It is not your primary source. It should never be thought of as your primary source. And I would say nothing from the government should ever be thought of as your primary source because it can change under policy whims. And so the more you can be self-reliant, the better that is. And so that's always been kind of my motivating factor. If I get Social Security, great. Oh, wow, that would be lovely if I have it. But I'm not planning on it. And worst case scenario, it means I have more money to give to something else when I'm 80.
Right.
Yep. I can live with that.
We can spend it all on donuts or bike parts. Or philanthropy to your favorite organization.
Exactly. Or I can live with my kids. Like, you know, I can, there are different things I can do. And as long as I don't have to freak out about it. So but I'm also risk averse, and I also worry about these sort of things.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, everybody on this that listens to the shows knows I'm very risk averse. So. So this is the way I like to wrap up every show. I like to ask every guest, which is, what is the best financial decision you've ever made, and what is the worst?
Oh, geez. Well, the best is when I was in graduate school. So I know you've been hammering this on your listeners, but I will do this too. I was making $10,000 a year, and I made sure to put $2,000 a year in my Roth IRA, in my IRA.
That's right, fabulous.
Which was ridiculous. trying to live on $10,000 in Palo Alto was,
wow.
but it was the early 90s, so it was okay. But the limit was only $2,000 a year, so I did that every year. And then my last year of graduate school, we came out with the Roth, and so I converted.
Oh.
Which meant I paid all the taxes up front, but my tax rate was still low because I was still a poor graduate student. But I was like, I'm going to pay this and bite the bullet. And I added probably 3 more years. So I've had 8 years of adding, so maybe 16,000. And it's grown since then.
That's awesome.
So it's my little pot of money that I don't even think about. I can't add to it now because I make too much.
Yeah.
Yay. excuse me. But I put it away, and it's worth a good little bit of money. And so that's nice to have. So. The fact that my parents yelled at me and said, make sure you do this. And I was like, okay, I will do this. And it worked. And so, my hope is that when, my daughter gets old enough, okay, we're opening this and we're going to start it. So that was my best thing. My worst. So my wife and I, back in 2006, we weren't married. We were engaged. And we were moving to Atlanta.
Ooh.
In part because we were going to solve the 4-hour commute problem that we had. So this is one of the magic things that people have is you meet somebody and it's in a completely different state, and mine happened to be 3 states away, and we're in the Northeast. 4 hours in the snow, not fun. So we were going to get to the same place, and I'm an academic and she's a policy wonk, and trying to find the right place, we ended up in Atlanta. So we're moving in 2006. And the one thing we wanted to do is we're like, we're going to start our life finally. Because we're both in our mid-30s. We've been renting forever. We're like, we're going to do this. So we bought a house.
In Atlanta in 2006.
In a gentrifying neighborhood. And we violated every rule of real estate. Don't buy the best house in the neighborhood. Blah, 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 blah. Like we violated all of it. Right? But the house was gorgeous and we loved it. But we also assumed we're never going to have kids. So who cares about the school district? We're going to live here forever. Who cares about that? Blah, 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 blah. So when did I move to Reed?
2010?
Yeah. So I had to sell in 2010.
Oh, that's rough.
That's rough. And at that point, I had a kid. At that point, I had to figure out, how am I selling this house? How do I get out of this? And so the lesson learned, and I hope everybody thinks of it this way, housing is a consumption good. It is not an investment. And as long as you view it that way, housing is great. You don't have to worry about it.
Yep.
But don't ever view it as the thing that's going to be your nest egg. No. It is a consumption good. And I know I now teach that all the time at Reed. Housing is consumption. And people always look at you funny. And then I'm like, because 2010 happened.
Yep. And, we've talked before on the show, buy versus rent, but the most important factor in buy versus rent is not the timing of the market or, you need to build wealth using your house. The most important thing for buy versus rent is that you want to own a house and you are financially ready to do so, and literally nothing else matters.
Yep.
There's plenty of good reasons to buy a house, but your retirement plan being a house is not one of them.
Exactly. I mean, we could afford the house. We were affording it fine. That wasn't the issue. The issue was, crap, I need to sell. And so one of the things that the house does is it limits your ability to move.
Yep.
And so if you're thinking about mobility or job opportunities, you want something that you can get out of quickly. So if you don't envision your job being stable, or you envision, I want to move somewhere else, keeping mobility is one of the big reasons to keep renting.
Yep. Yeah, definitely. And, breaking a lease is expensive and not fun. No one likes it.
Yep.
But it's a lot less expensive than even just realtor's fees and possibly paying a mortgage for several months on a house while you try to sell it on the market.
Well, I was scared to death I was going to be a renter, be a landlord. Ooh. From Oregon of property in Atlanta.
Is that how long it took to...
The story is twofold. Is one, we had the house under contract. My appendix decided it wanted to stay in Georgia.
Ooh.
So on the day that they took my appendix to leave it in Georgia, the contract fell through.
Oh my gosh.
But my wife wouldn't tell me because I was about to lose my appendix. And so she didn't tell me that they bailed.
Oh no.
So we thought we were going to have to move to Portland, but then we found somebody miraculously because we just kept cutting the price. And the real estate agents didn't believe that, well, shouldn't you argue for $5,000 more? No, because the cost of me holding this house for 6 months are more than $5,000. So no, drop it.
Yep.
And finally getting a real estate agent who understood that because their interests are not aligned with yours.
Right, totally.
Which people don't realize. You know, got us rid of the house. So we got a second person to come in and get rid of it. And so we got rid of it right before we left.
Well.
Which, thank God.
Because, I'm glad you got rid of it.
Yeah.
Were you, what, if you bought it in 2006, how much were you paying in interest on that?
How much were we paying? Five.
Five? That's not bad, though. I
not
mean.
Not bad. Not bad.
Not crazy 2007 levels.
No. No, but, you know, now I'm paying 3.25.
Yeah, yeah. Totally.
And I probably should have Yeah,
it's too late now, though.
Too late now. I'm fine.
All right. Thank you so much for coming on, John. This was great. I hope that folks aren't too overwhelmed by the policy. The most important thing is have your own plan. Don't let the government's plan be yours. But also don't freak out.
Exactly. Exactly.
That wraps our show for today. Our producer is Will Romey. Our intro music is by Aaron Parecki. And I'm Lillian Kerr-Bake, your personal finance educator and host. Thanks for listening. Until next time, remember to manage your money so it doesn't manage you.